You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts on Spotify or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Hello, and welcome to this fireside chat of the Center on Regulation and Markets at the Brookings Institution. My name is Sanjay Patnaik, and I'm the director of the center. In our series of fireside chats, we explore important topics related to modern-day markets and regulations through one-on-one conversations with regulators, business executives, and academics. Today, it is my pleasure to welcome two distinguished guests. First, we have Dr. Mark Lipsitch, who is the professor of epidemiology at Harvard University. He has a primary appointment in the Department of Epidemiology and an affiliated appointment in the Department of Immunology and Infectious Diseases. He directs the Center for Communicable Disease Dynamics, which is a center of excellence funded by MIDAS, of the NIH and NIGMS. And he also is an associate director of the Interdisciplinary Concentration in Infectious Disease Epidemiology. Second, we have Alina Chan, who is a molecular biologist and specializes in gene therapy and cell engineering. She currently is a postdoctoral fellow at the Broad Institute of MIT and Harvard, a renowned biomedical and genomic research center. Thank you, Mark. Thank you, Alina, for being here. You have to unmute both of you, please.
Thanks for having us.
All right. So as you all know, the COVID pandemic has had a devastating impact in terms of human and economic costs. And it has really shown us, I think, how vulnerable the world is to virus outbreaks that can spiral out of control. And so I think we see emerging consensus that there is a need to prepare our regulatory system, our policymaking system, our health systems to try to prevent future pandemic like this. If we just look at the staggering costs of the lockdowns, of the human lives lost, it is obviously better if we try to prevent future pandemics by investing proactively and by implementing measures to reduce the likelihood for a future pandemic. So why is it important in this context to find the origins of the COVID-19 pandemic to try to prevent future pandemics? And I'd like to start with Mark, please.
Well, I think for the obvious reasons that when you know what causes something, we have really very few pandemics to work with in our historical experience. We know of the four in the last 100 years from flu, and we have some near pandemics from coronaviruses, and now this coronavirus pandemic, and then some other outbreaks of great concern that were not pandemics. So each pandemic provides a window into a very, very rare event. And so when we say, oh, it always happens a certain way, always means four or five or six times. And so the seventh might be really different. And so I think that means that each pandemic is a very important data point in calibrating us to how we think about the risks. So when we are looking at different possible origins for this pandemic, understanding which pathway led to it, or even which pathways might have led to it, and which ones we can rule out as being impossible, is helpful in thinking about how to prioritize our prevention measures in the future.
Great, thank you. Alina, what do you think about that?
Yes, I agree with Mark. Clearly, the mitigation strategies for each type of pandemic, whether based on a natural spillover from animal to human, or whether from a lab accident, are extremely different. So the ways that you prevent a natural spillover is completely different from the ways that you prevent a lab accident resulting in an outbreak. And I think it's also important to set a precedent, a system of accountability and transparency in terms of tracking the origins of any outbreak in any country. This doesn't apply to just China, because outbreaks can happen anywhere that there's a lab or anywhere there's an interface between animals and humans, there can be an outbreak. And there needs to be an international system where people can rapidly go in and investigate without pointing fingers, without blaming anybody, just for the sake of public health, to find the source of an outbreak.
Great, thank you. So both of you co-authored an article with more than 15 other scientists in science calling for an objective, fact-based inquiry into the origins of the COVID pandemic. What prompted you to write this letter now? Mark, please.
I think it might be a different answer for each of the 18 or so authors. In my case, I would say that I had been interested in the question of origins, but not very focused on it because my work is my day job is infectious disease epidemiology, and I had been trying to work very hard on responding to the pandemic in various research-based ways and to its consequences rather than its origin. I think the two precipitating events for me are first that the pandemic was beginning to, at least locally, become a little bit less all-consuming, and therefore that I had a bit more bandwidth, and also that the WHO report, I think, left a lot of people with the sense that this is going to be the final word unless people get together and say this should not be the final word. And so I think for me, that was an important driver.
Great. And Alina?
Yeah. So at that time, at the end of March, the first phase of the China WHO joint study had just concluded. And they had essentially ruled out a lab leak, even though their wording was a bit more nuanced. So they said it was extremely unlikely and they would not follow up anymore. It triggered a response from even the WHO Director General, who said that he was ready to deploy new missions to investigate a lab leak origin, and numerous countries put out their own independent statements saying that we need a timely and transparent investigation, so a next phase or even a new investigation. So amongst the 18 signatories of the Science Letter, several of us felt that this was the time for top scientists, so not including myself, but definitely the 17 other very prominent and well-respected scientists to express scientific support for a credible investigation of not just natural hypothesis, but also a lab-based origin hypothesis.
Great, and so you alluded to it already, right? I mean, this is really a scientific question, right? It is a question of what data do we have, what evidence do we have that we can rule out either one of the other, or at least try to test those hypotheses, right? And so based on the US intelligence assessments, it looks like the two most likely hypotheses are either a natural spillover from an animal host, for instance, a bat, that has been the prevalent theory for the last 1.5 years, or a leak from a biolab in Wuhan, China, where some research on coronaviruses is conducted. Can you please lay out for people that are not as familiar with the debate, what is the current state of evidence or lack thereof for either one of the two hypotheses? And I'd love to start with Alina, please.
Yes, I can really go to town on this, but I'll try and keep it brief.
So, brief overview, just yes. Really the main points.
Where we are right now, we're 1.5 years post-outbreak detection in Wuhan City. We have not found any dispositive evidence, and I learned this word from writing the Science Letter with the other 17 scientists, but what that really means, no dispositive evidence, means that there's no evidence that directly supports or can rule out any of the hypotheses. So you cannot support or rule out either a natural origin, a spillover in the market, or a lab accident resulting in this pandemic. All of the pieces of evidence we have right now entirely circumstantial. So we're talking about genetic evidence, historical evidence, so we're talking about precedents of spillovers versus lab leaks, epidemiological evidence, so the very little information we know about the early cases, and not just in China, but outside of China as well. These are all consistent with either a natural or a lab origin. And so just going back to that historical evidence too, this is often cited as one reason why many scientists think that this was natural, because they look at the past outbreaks and they say those have all been natural, so why should we expect anything different? But what the public doesn't seem to be very aware of is that for the first SARS virus in 2003, it spilled over naturally more than once, actually once in 2002 and then again in 2003, but it also spilled from labs 4 to 6 times in different countries. So there is a way, there's a mechanism for viruses to either have a natural origin or a lab origin.
Mm-hmm. Great, thank you. And so I want to turn to you, Mark. Maybe if you can add a little bit to this, but also what information and data would it take as scientists and scholars to rule out one or the other hypothesis? And what steps would government investigators need to take to collect some of the relevant data?
Yeah, I think Alina put the state of the evidence really well. I would maybe just add that In addition to the spillovers of SARS-1 from laboratories, there was the 2007 foot and mouth outbreak that came from a laboratory in Surrey, England. That's not the big one, but it was a subsequent smaller one that did lead to transmission of infections. And there's some thought that the 1977 reappearance of H1N1 flu probably also came from some sort of a laboratory event, although it's a little unclear what. So this is not science fiction. This is historical conjecture. So I think in terms of the evidence that's required, I'm not convinced that we will ever know the answer. I think a credible investigation has much value, even if it doesn't come to a conclusion, because it shows that the international community made the appropriate effort. But the kinds of evidence that I think, among the kinds of evidence that I think would be important, would be for looking at the natural spillover, would be further investigations of natural hosts of coronaviruses, and particularly those that are closest to this particular virus, and for the laboratory origin. I mean, I think there are a number of types of evidence. Those would include the records, the detailed records of the laboratory, the detailed health records of people in Wuhan, not just the three laboratory workers who have been understood to have gotten sick with something that was like COVID around the right time, but also of others associated with the lab, serological data on the laboratory workers, records from within the laboratory. So there are a lot of things, but again, you know, we don't know where Ebola comes from. We think it's bats, but there are 25, at least 26 or 7 now, major spillover events that we know about of Ebola, and no specific source has been tracked, as far as I'm aware, for any of those. You know, it's not all about the answer; it's also about the quest.
That's actually interesting. I didn't know that about Ebola. So as both of you laid out, we have these two competing hypotheses, and they have vastly different implications for regulators and policymakers. And as governments around the world are now trying to consider how can we prevent this from happening again, Elena, I want to start breaking down a little bit the natural host theory, right? So can you give us example of previous viruses that made the jump from an animal host to humans? I think you alluded to some already. And how does the transmission chain and the mutation of the virus exactly work usually in this case? How does it jump from one species basically to humans?
Yeah, so the story of the origin changes for every single virus, right? And also depends on when they emerged in humans for the first time. So some of them have emerged like very early in the 1900s. So that is not super useful as a comparison to SARS-CoV-2, especially considering the technologies we have today. We can just throw a whole patient sample in the sequencer and get the genomes of the virus in like a day if you push really hard. So that technology was not available in the 1900s. And so the one that I like to compare SARS to, COVID-19 to, is SARS-1, because the circumstances are extremely similar. They both appeared late in the year. There was a market involved in the story. They are both SARS viruses. They use the same receptor. They have very similar biology compared to all the other viruses that have emerged in humans so far. And they have a similar host range. So they're both this type of generalist virus that can infect not just humans, but several other mammals, like ferret badgers, raccoon dogs, civet cats, mink. So they're both very comparable. And importantly, SARS-1 also emerged in the 21st century. So the technologies, even in the last 20 years, have dramatically improved. But at least there's some level of similarity there that we know how to sequence. We know how to like interpret genes and check binding to receptors, that kind of thing. So in the case of SARS-1, what scientists saw and validated is that over the first few months when it had just spilled from an animal into humans, possibly civets into humans, it was gaining mutations that made it better at infecting and spreading amongst humans. And so this has become quite a popular hypothesis of how a virus first jumps over from animals to humans, is that it requires this environment where this interface results in a lot of viruses from animals being exposed to humans. So there's a lot of opportunity for these viruses to jump the species barrier. And once it jumps the species barrier, it needs to get better. So in early 2020, some experts expressed concern that they would see the same thing happening with SARS-2, that the virus would get better at infecting humans. But we didn't see that. So in the first few months, there were no signs of this virus getting more transmissible or causing more disease in humans.
That's actually interesting because you wrote a paper on it, right? And you said in that paper that had the virus jumped from animals to humans, one would expect some of those adaptations to happen. But you concluded that this already looked like it was pre-adapted to human transmission, COVID-19, right? So
yes.
Can you please elaborate a little bit more on that? And is it possible that your finding could also be consistent with a natural transmission theory or with that hypothesis or not?
Yes. So I think the principle there is explained already that even though both SARS-1 and SARS-2 are generalist virus, meaning that they can infect a whole bunch of different species, once they cross a species barrier, there's some room for improvement. So it's not 100% effective at infecting all species. It just means that they can cross the barrier quite easily. Once they get across, though, there's space to improve. And we didn't see that improvement, that rapid improvement in SARS-2 compared to SARS-1. But it doesn't mean that it came from a lab. It really doesn't. So in the preprint itself, we forwarded three scenarios, and two were natural. So one of it was is still more favored by scientists, I'd say, is that we missed that period. It had been circulating in humans for maybe a few months or even a year at a low transmission, maybe not even inside Wuhan, but just one person brought it in there, a super spreader event happened at the market, let's say. So similar to the hotel super spreader event in SARS-1, where a doctor brought it out of Guangdong into Hong Kong and started a super spreader. So that's one possibility. So we still need to investigate that. We still need to see, was there transmission of COVID-19 outside of Wuhan prior to December 2019, right? And then the second scenario was where it was already this great inside an animal. It was already somehow an animal extremely closely similar to humans. Maybe a primate was around in Wuhan City or wherever the spillover event occurred, and the virus just jumped into humans and had very little room for improvement. I think that's a little bit more speculative because it requires an animal host very similar to humans to be exposed to humans at a high enough frequency that those viruses can jump over. And the last one was an accidental lab leak.
That's actually really illuminating. Thank you. I also want to bring Mark a little bit into this here. So as we can imagine, if viruses emerge like that naturally, it would be really good to have like an early warning system and regulations in place to kind of like monitor for these things. And so can you talk a little bit about what kind of systems do we have in place currently to monitor the emergence of viruses in the US and globally? And how frequently do we observe such like transmissions from animals to humans?
Yeah, I want to just add a little bit on to Alina's point. I completely agree with what she said. I would just add that, you know, there are experimental sciences and there are historical sciences. You know, physics is the classic experimental, and perhaps astronomy is the most historical, and geology. And the pandemics are kind of in between, but more on the historical side. Like biology is an experimental science, but pandemic science, we have, you know, four flu pandemics, depending on how you count, that we've observed carefully, and one now coronavirus pandemic and some near misses. So I organized a symposium in Cambridge, England, a few years ago, where we tried to figure out what are the three most important characteristics of a flu virus that make it capable of a pandemic. And what I think the most interesting thing we understood at the end of that couple of days and writing a paper together, which I can put in the chat in a few minutes when I'm not talking, is that had we made generalizations about what was pandemic capable based on pre-2009, on all three dimensions, arguably, we would have said this virus cannot cause a pandemic. We would have said it has a score of 0 out of 3 in terms of capabilities when it needs a 3 out of 3. And then it pushed the envelope a little. It was a little bit outside what was possible before. And now we have a larger set. So these historical sciences are very are epistemologically different from physics. To answer your actual question, there are a set of mechanisms, both more formal ones and more informal ones. There is country-level reporting to the World Health Organization, which is voluntary, of unusual health events. There are rules around it that I'm not expert in, but there's some discretion, at least, at the country level. There is a thing called ProMed, which is an informal system by which people report unusual clusters of illnesses and including plant and animal illnesses. There are systems for depositing sequence data when they're detected that are maintained at the national and international levels. But there is not sort of a bulletproof shield as we've seen. There's a whole lot to be done to improve that system so that we have a better chance of detecting early the next time. Just to give one example, it's often the case, and was the case in the U.S., that early surveillance defines the people who can be tested as those who have a connection, in this case, to Wuhan or to China. Mm-hmm. So in the early days of the pandemic, you could not get a SARS-CoV-2 test because they were so scarce unless you had a connection to Wuhan and later to China. That meant that if there was community transmission, we had a system that was designed not to see it, and indeed didn't see it, and it was not until the Seattle flu study decided to take matters into its own hands that we began to see community transmission. And then once we looked, we saw it many other places. So just as a small example, but a really important one, we need to design these systems from the beginning to find what we are looking for, but also what we're not yet looking for.
And I really do hope that the pandemic will change the way of thinking of policymakers, because I mean, I think traditionally public health, even though people have warned of these pandemics for many years, public health has not been on the priority list of many governments. But I think this really puts it to the forefront to institute a system that can help us detect some of those. Elena, do you have anything to add here, especially also kind of like how often do we observe these animal to human transmissions? Is that something very likely, or does that not happen too often?
It seems to happen, but it's not so likely to the point where we need to be worried every time we touch an animal from now on. The lab in Wuhan, and actually several labs in Wuhan, had been studying exactly this problem, how frequently the SARS virus spill over from animals to humans. And they had to go to quite remote places to see that happening. So they had to go to these villages that were so close to bat caves that the villagers would commonly see bats swarming over the village or falling down on the village. And they had to go to these villages that were close to caves where they knew that SARS virus could be found. So this is not a situation where every single person who lives near a bat cave in Southeast Asia or China is exposed to SARS. And even amongst those people, they found as low as 0.6% to about 2.7% of them had antibodies against SARS-like viruses. So it was still a rare event. And when they queried the people who had these antibodies, most of them had never left the village. It was that remote. Like, they weren't like taking high-speed trains or planes around the country. So this is still like a rare event. I think that's a good thing, is that the opportunity for spillover is not that great. And even where it is significant, it's not next to an international airport.
Mm-hmm. That's actually really interesting and good to know. And I want to move to Mark, something what you had mentioned earlier, right? You had listed a few examples of previous virus outbreaks, moving now to the second hypothesis, to the lab leaks, right? That were the result of lab leaks. And can you talk a little bit about how these leaks happen and how commonly do these happen, these lab leaks, in the U.S. or internationally, in labs that are related to virus research?
The common thread in almost every laboratory accident that's known about, and I would say actually with both laboratory accidents, accidental infections, and also human spillovers from animals, most of them we would never know about. So antibody studies can help in that sort of thing. But part of the problem in trying to assess the rarity or commonness is that reported is a very small and different fraction for the two types of events. But I think the common feature in the accidents that we know about has been human error. People imagine that it's like the spacesuit breaks and ventilation starts going the wrong way or something. That's not the problem. The problem
Oh.
is almost always that somebody switches a vial, mislabels a vial, or believes that a vial of a live pathogen has been killed completely when it's been either switched or not killed completely, or it's been contaminated, one of the SARS, one of the laboratory leaks in the early 2000s was, I can't remember if it was the West Nile one or one of the SARS ones, was due to a contamination. So it's human error, which is the hardest thing in a way to stop. And so I think when people imagine these very high tech labs, they either imagine they're bulletproof, or that when they fail, it's the fancy stuff that fails. What usually fails is the humans. And so I think that's why those of us who are worried about certain kinds of experiments that pose a pandemic risk are not really reassured by the quality of the spacesuits.
I actually want to talk a little bit about that because a lot of news stories now have been about so-called gain of function research, right? Where scientists enhance the pathogenicity or transmissibility of viruses. And so proponents of the research argue it really can help us potentially predict future viruses that could cause a pandemic. But opponents argue that it's really too risky to conduct such research because these modified viruses could escape from a lab and cause a pandemic in the first place. And especially maybe in labs that are in big population centers, which many of those are. And so, Mark, you have come out strongly against gain-of-function research and advocated for a moratorium of that type of research, which I think the U.S. had instituted from 2014 to 2017. Can you talk a little bit about your viewpoint and why you oppose that kind of research?
Yeah, it's a very long answer also, which I'll try to keep short.
I would imagine.
First thing to say is that the laboratory hypothesis has two flavors for the SARS-CoV-2 emergence. One is that it was a manipulated virus in some kind of experiment, and the other is that it was a virus that had been gathered from a natural sample and then infected a human through a laboratory. Mm-hmm. So it does not, the laboratory hypothesis is separable from gain of function. Mm-hmm. The second important distinction is that there are many kinds of functions that viruses can be made to gain in a laboratory. Some of those I'm completely supportive of, mm-hmm. And some of them I think are extremely concerning. To give an example of the first, there has been work to make coronaviruses before SARS-CoV-2 infect mice efficiently so that they can be used to develop countermeasures such as drugs and vaccines. Mm. That kind of work was included in the initial NIH moratorium briefly. Everybody I know, including me, thought that was a bad idea, and it was removed fairly quickly once they realized they had been overzealous. Mm-hmm. So there are gains of function that are well justified from the public health perspective and also relatively low risk, as that one was.
Okay.
The type of studies that we've been, my colleagues and I in the Cambridge Working Group and others have been opposed to are what we call potential pandemic pathogen studies, which is the creation of novel viruses that start from something that is not transmissible in humans or not pathogenic in humans, and where the goal is to make it have those properties. And those types of studies, I would argue, have almost no value in terms of predicting pandemics, and have extreme risks because their entire scientific validity rests on creating something that's inherently dangerous. If you don't create something dangerous, the experiment was a failure.
Okay, that actually makes a lot of sense. And what regulations do we have currently in place to on those labs that conduct gain-of-function research of the type that you're talking about, the dangerous one? Do we have regulations in the U.S. for those labs and globally?
There's not really a global system. There is a national approach, which if you read some of the recent press reports, there's some suggestion that it's not carefully followed. And I can't evaluate that because of the nature of the approach, which is that the policy is that when a proposal is made by an investigator for government funding for a type of research that might be creating a potential pandemic pathogen. It is flagged for extra review at the level of the Secretary of Health and Human Services. That flagging is not a public event. The review is not a public event. The names of the reviewers are not public. The names, the content of the risk assessment is not public. The content of the benefit assessment is not public, and the content of the weighing of those two is not public.
Wow.
So there is some number of these, and a colleague just asked me today, do we have a list? And I said, as far as I know, there is none. There were two that were that went through that process that a journalist from Science Magazine found by their sources, but this is not a public event. And the only justification given for that extreme level of secrecy is to protect the intellectual property and the sort of tradecraft of the scientists. And while I believe those are very important means to other ends, such as innovation, encouraging innovation, I think everybody should agree that they are not ends in themselves. Intellectual property, if you invent something that is, if you want to work in a field where you are creating risks at the population level, you should be willing to do it in a way that that is open enough so that people can evaluate those risks.
I mean, that's a clear case of negative externalities, right? That the public probably has a right to know about. I want to move to Alina. What do you think of gain-of-function research of the type that Mark talked about, the one that is more dangerous? And have there been any concrete examples where gain-of-function research has led to a development of a new vaccine or cure? And on the other hand, and this is open to both of you, have there been examples where gain-of-function research has led to a virus that escaped the lab and caused some problems?
Yeah, so this whole term gain-of-function research, I think Mark has sort of spoken about this as well. It's quite contentious, and it's a pain point for many scientists because it's not extremely well-defined. And so there's some experiments that are clearly gain-of-function, experiments where you intentionally force viruses or bacteria to become more infectious or cause more severe disease. Those, I'd say, almost have zero benefit, and I think a lot of people will agree. But there's a lot in the gray area where even the work that was that EcoHealth Alliance got funding for and gave some of that money to the WIV, the Wuhan Institute of Virology, a lot of people cannot decide if that is gain of function or not, where they are switching in parts of viruses between natural viruses in the wild versus well-characterized backbones in the lab. It's more contentious whether that's gain of function research. I mean, some scientists very strongly believe that's gain of function research. But in my opinion, they even posted their grant online. That means they weren't hiding anything. They were not doing any secret work. So like that kind of research, I think that there's some value in it, even though it was too late for this pandemic. So clearly it did not contribute to no vaccine for this pandemic. All we needed for this pandemic for the vaccines was the sequence of the virus. Yeah. And then that mRNA vaccine developers or the adenovirus developers could just put the sequence in and make their vaccine. But I do see that their efforts to try and build this pan-coronavirus vaccine, so a vaccine that's broad spectrum, that targets every type of SARS coronavirus, let's say. And I think that there is value in that work. But the question here is, I feel like it shouldn't be, is this work gain of function? The question should be, how can we do this work in a very safe way while keeping the benefits? And some very safe ways of doing it is, one, having a very timely and transparent database. So the moment you collect it and sequence it, it should go straight into an international database so people are aware of what you're working with. That way we don't have these questions later on of, did this come from a lab or is it from nature? And the other might just be to relocate the lab. So we know now that this work had been misestimated as a lower level of biosafety requirements. So this work in Wuhan had been done at BSL-2, one of the lowest biosafety levels, where they dealt with live SARS-related coronaviruses that they knew could grow in human cells and could infect cells using the human ACE2 receptor. If that work had not been done in Wuhan, in the highly densely populated area right next to the international airport, we can fly to almost every continent from China, then the risk would be much lower of something, of a lab accident resulting in outbreak. So I think there are ways to keep doing this research, which we don't even know whether or not it's gain of function, but in a safer way.
Actually, that you bring up a good point, and I want to ask Mark on that. So what regulations, even regardless of the gain of function research, what regulations do the research labs that conduct research on human or animal viruses are currently facing in the US, if there are any, and which agencies supervise those regulations or these labs?
There's a thing called an institutional biosafety committee at each research institution, which is sort of tasked with enforcing mainly federal guidelines, and also I guess state and local guidelines or regulations on the conduct of research and of deciding what level of biosafety should be used. I think it's fair to say that no institutional biosafety committee that I would recognize as such would have said do use BSL-2, biosafety level 2, for the coronaviruses of the type that Alina just described. I think that's a difference of quality of regulation. But the rules are actually, I probably am not the right person to ask about the details of the legal structure, but institutions are bound by federals and state and sometimes local. Cambridge, Massachusetts is famous for regulating recombinant DNA. So there is there are multiple levels, but there is not a global minimum standard, and I think that is an area for work. And I would just, in answer to your earlier question about the has there been a gain of function experiment that led to a outbreak? I'm not aware of any. And I think that's important to say. I think what's also important to say is, in a spirit of equal transparency, is that, you know, as Alina pointed out, we didn't need the animal virus data to make the coronavirus 2 vaccine. We needed the sequence of this virus, and we needed the basis of work which had been done for several years on adenoviral vectors, mRNA technology, and MERS and SARS vaccines, sponsored by the U.S. government, by CEPI, and by perhaps others. And the reason we were doing that was not because people had been prospecting in caves and finding bat coronaviruses. The reason we did that was because of MERS and SARS, two human outbreaks. And the reason why when we next have a flu pandemic, we will have hopefully better technology for the flu vaccines is not because people have been examining avian viruses. It's going to be because people have been dealing with human seasonal flu and human pandemic flu. So I think there's just a bit of, in my opinion, exaggeration in saying that we need to know the entire scale of natural threats. Because of course it would be nice to know if it was costless in risk and money, it would be nice to know. But in fact, the way we make vaccines is by things that have killed people when they've caused outbreaks, and not anything else much pretty much not.
So that's actually an interesting point. And also your earlier point, I think that there are no international standards for those labs. I think this is really a huge gap, because then people can just open these labs in different countries with different standards, even though this affects the entire world, because as we saw, the pandemic travels very quickly. Actually, I want to talk about that, and starting with Mark. So we have seen multiple close calls to a global pandemic, I would say, over the past 20 years, right, including SARS-1, MERS, and then Ebola. And so what was different this time that we couldn't contain the virus outbreak as compared to those other cases?
I think it's a set of things, but if I had to identify one, there's a paper by Christoph Fraser and colleagues a few years ago called What Makes a Virus Outbreak Controllable? Mm-hmm. And the answer is, if it's not very contagious, and if almost all the transmission is from symptomatic, identifiably symptomatic people, okay. And this is 0 for 2 on those, right? It's pretty contagious. It's not as contagious as some things, but it has a reasonably high reproduction number, and the estimate is around 40% or perhaps more of the transmission is from people with no symptoms or at least no distinctive symptoms. And that is, I think, the the short answer. The long answer includes global disorganization, poor public health systems in some of the countries that were infected early and didn't know it for a long time, and a number of other things. But I think the Ebola was controllable because you could tell who had it and either vaccinate around them or isolate them or both. SARS, similarly, only sick people infected others. And pandemic flu, on the contrary, is not containable for pretty much the same reason that SARS-2 has not been containable.
Elena, do you have anything to add?
Yeah, I think one big obstacle is really transparency, right? So having information as soon as possible helps everybody. And having the wrong information can really derail a tracking community spread. So early in the outbreak of COVID-19, I think that there had been a misunderstanding that the market was ground zero. And so cases were evaluated not just by symptoms, but actually mostly by whether they had been exposed to the market. So that means that they were looking for people who were around the market, who had gone to the market. So they missed a whole bunch of people. And the same thing applied to travelers outside of Wuhan who had left Wuhan to other countries. They were queried on whether they went to the market or not. So when that happens, like Mark said, you miss this whole side of the pandemic. And that can really blindside the efforts to contain the spread of the disease.
Great, thank you. I really want to move kind of like into the way forward, right? So policymakers will have to think hard what kind of policies to put in place to prevent future pandemics, taking a hard look at the existing regulatory and public health processes. And oftentimes, as we saw, public health resources are limited. And so it's important to prioritize those that kind of like really can help us with that. So let's assume that the COVID-19 pandemic was originated from a natural host. What specific policies and regulations should the U.S. government implement to improve early warning systems and preparedness for such viruses? I start with Mark and then move over to Elena.
I would say that the U.S. government alone isn't going to be able to do much if we just acted alone. But at a global level, I think much better surveillance and testing, sharing technologies to do efficient testing for known and unknown pathogens in human respiratory cases around the world, and especially in areas where there's a lot of contact with animals, would be my first and probably second and third recommendation. At the level of the United States, I think the thing that I mentioned earlier and Alina also just mentioned about improving the way that we act when we know that there might be something that we haven't yet detected, using broad case definitions. It's a very detailed public health point, but as those two examples show, in China and then here, we lost valuable time because of a definition, fundamentally.
Elena, what are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I think for any country, these preparedness or ways to detect outbreak early, they're not just natural versus lab specific. Actually, there's a lot of overlap. So there's a lot of things you can do to detect it. And one way could be as simple as testing the wastewater at your airports, so that when there's like outbreak in any city that's coming in, or wastewater from each plane, you could test that for pathogens. And this doesn't require you to have a whole network of people sampling viruses or wastewater in each country. Just test your own airport. But a lot of it is also getting access to people at the outbreak site. So being able to directly speak to doctors or to public health experts at the site of outbreak in a timely manner, instead of having a gag order placed on them, having access to samples, patient samples, storing those at least, not destroying them immediately. having a system in place to store samples before and during the outbreak is extremely important, and giving access to that is important.
That's a really interesting idea. And also kind of like going back to your point, Mark, on the global level, right? So when we think about what kind of warning systems we can put in place on the global level, should these efforts be reinforced within the WHO? Or do you think we need kind of like a new institutional framework for like an early warning pandemic body, maybe, so to speak?
I'm going to pass on that question because I think governance is beyond my range of competencies.
No problem. Alina, I want to move to you. Kind of like, if you think about, you already mentioned the idea about the testing the waters for the airports, right? What other policies or safeguards, or even kind of like best practices among scientists, do you think could be useful if it turns out that the COVID pandemic was caused by a lab leak?
Yeah, so I want to also clarify that I think we already know the answer for preventing natural spillovers, and we've known the answer for years. So it's to reduce these interfaces between animals and humans. It just seems to have not been enough of an incentive to stop that
Yeah,
interface
that's
from
true.
being. But for a lab-based pandemic, it's a new risk. So this requires a whole bunch of new discussions among scientists and non-scientists together to figure out like what's the most responsible way for science to move forward, for research to be regulated and reviewed, not just by scientists but stakeholders, people who live in the city. I mean, obviously, there's some things that would be great, like and some French virologists have suggested this is having a black box in each institute that does research on pathogens. This could be
Interesting.
something like collecting the wastewater again, or collecting samples from the personnel at the institute, not just the researchers, but also like the janitorial staff and things like that. So having regular tests, not blood tests, but just like swabs and things like that is sufficient to have a monitoring system. And that helps the country where the lab is located, because you may not have to report that to the WHO, but at least it means you're watching what's happening in your own labs. And so there's so many ways to prevent a lab-based accident. We just need to have a conversation about it.
I think that's really important, right? And so that actually brings me to another question, which directly affects your field as scientists, right? And so I think one thing that surprised me during the debate is that I think the debate about the origins of the pandemic has brought about the potential for groupthink among scientists, which are humans like all of us. And we also see serious disagreements in the scientific community now, especially on the origin theory. So, but what is really important for us is to have trust in science and scientists, right? Our technology, our society is built around that. And so what can scientists do in the future to ensure that the scientific process leads to where the data and evidence point? I've been surprised, for instance, to see scientists claim that one or the other hypothesis is true without having data to actually really verify that. And so how's the way forward for scientists, and how can you maintain the trust of the public, especially for the layman public that often doesn't understand how the scientific process works, how disagreement works? I want to start with you, Alina, because you've been really objective in the discussion. You've been standing out with trying to look at all facts and only making claims that can be supported by facts. So how do you see the debate going on?
Well, I hope so. I think I'm learning by error as well, trial and error. There have been moments where I've been very scared, the moments that I think I've made mistakes. I think it's based on sincerity, like working to get people's trust, investing in science communication, investing in science communicators who understand science deeply. So I think that I understand why this problem had so much, why the topic of the origins was so unfortunately not well explained by scientists and science communicators. They were afraid. They were afraid that they couldn't tell the public that they didn't know. So expressing uncertainty is very dangerous and scary for scientists especially. But we have to learn to be able to communicate uncertainty. And the second thing was a fear of a backlash from the public. So right now that's kind of happening a bit, where a lot of people in the public, or at least on social media, trying to hold scientists accountable. And by that, I don't mean like a fair trial. I mean like they want to come with you with pitchforks and things like that. So like that's dangerous too. I think it's so important to have a safe space for scientists to communicate with the public, and for the public to communicate to scientists. So not having that back and forth in a safe space is what has led to a lot of the troubles we see today around this origins topic.
That's really interesting. And over to you, Mark. Same question, especially because you have been a preeminent leader in your field for a very long time. And so how do you view that debate and those issues arising in the scientific community?
Yeah, my views have been evolving a lot during the course of this pandemic, mostly on other topics besides the origin. And I've come to the view that we shouldn't trust scientists more than we trust, more or less than we trust other people. We should trust science. And when scientists speak science, we should trust them, because we should recognize that they are speaking in a way that is based on evidence. And when scientists express political views or policy preferences or even claims about how the world is that are not citing evidence, we should not give those scientists undue deference. They're people, as you said. We are people. I'm a scientist. and so I think I've become more aware during the pandemic that scientists sort of signing broad proclamations about how they think the world is not actually a very productive activity. What we should be doing, if we feel the need to express views, is as Alina and I and our colleagues did, to call for investigations. That's a statement. That's clearly a statement of a policy preference, and it's using our expertise, but it's not asserting something about the world. Yeah. Or assert things about the world and cite evidence. And I think there was a lot of that that was done well during the pandemic about masks and about other things later on, especially. And there was a lot of it was done badly, where people just asserted their favorite hypothesis and didn't support it. So I think, you know, people should expect scientists to defend their statements. And while virology is a complicated science, the types of evidence that we're bringing are not counterintuitive. They're not like outside of anyone's experience. They require interpretation, but I think we should be expected to justify what we say and to express how we know what we think we know.
And I think that that's a really interesting and nuanced point. I also think, going back to Alina's point, right, that it's important to have transparency, because I think what some of the reporting has shown that some of the scientists had conflicts of interest when making statements. And I think it's important to kind of like provide more transparency in the system. So I have actually some audience questions. So I want to ask one to Alina, which is related to the research process, right? So someone was asking, will there be a point in time where we can actually simulate a lot of the behavior of viruses with computational power instead of having to do it in a lab? So any response to that? I'm curious to hear, what do you think? How far along are we in that?
I think we're very far away from that future. Yeah. I mean, we've seen from this pandemic alone that models fail like 99% of the time. And Mark said, like Mark said, this is like you're only doing these data points retrospectively. You can't start a pandemic so you can gather data to train your machine learning models. even if you started a mink farm outbreak, that would be called gain of function research, unfortunately, because you're selecting for viruses to evolve over time. So like, we don't have the data points. That future where we can magically predict stuff with computational models is not here yet.
Maybe something for the future. And then Mark, I had a question for you. So if you look at the grant making process, right?
Can I respond to that one a little?
Sure, please. Why not?
So I think there is a lot we can predict and a lot we can't. From a molecular dynamics level of individual virus molecules within viruses up to transmission, there is a lot we can say. I think a lot of the failures were people interpreting models that said, if such and such behavior continues, then we will see such and such, and people imagining that was a statement, we will see such and such unconditionally. And that's nonsense. I mean, it's just, nobody should think that. That's like saying, you know, whether or not we light a fire, the temperature will be X. It's not true. I'm much more positive about the opportunities for quantitative studies, but we need to understand the if part of that as well as the then and the uncertainties. I didn't want to let
No, I think that's actually good. I'm glad you added that. One other question that came in, which is, I think, interesting, is if you look at the grant process, right, for like grants, I think for research that can have these negative externalities, do you think that the that grant process should be changed? Should it be more made more transparent, more public? And especially if some of those grants might go to subcontractors or partners of the grantees. So I'm curious what you think about that, both of you.
Yeah, I mean, I think for the reasons I stated a few minutes ago, I think the current U.S. System is ridiculously opaque and needs to be transparent along all those dimensions that I mentioned. And Tom Inglesby and I wrote a piece in M-Sphere in 2020 that actually came out the day of, I think the day before the Wuhan lockdown. As it happens, calling for better governance of that particular thing. I think at the global level, there's a lot of work to do. I do think the U.S. occupies a special role in that the you know, people have said, well, it'll just, the work will just go somewhere else. But for better or worse, the U.S. is perceived as and really is the global biomedical leader in many ways. And what the U.S. does matters for prestige of what other people do. If it's frowned on in the U.S., it will be not as easy to get published in fancy places and do all the things that scientists like to do. So I think we shouldn't imagine that, you know, the U.S. is powerless in terms of regulation. And in that article with Inglesby, we set out some suggestions for how journals could contribute to this regulatory framework by requiring wherever you come from, that there be such a process. So that could help the, you know, just as they require institutional review board review of human subjects, no matter where you come from. Similarly, you could expect that same thing. And I think negative externalities is exactly the right way of thinking, and it's natural for people who think about regulation. It has not been, it's hard to imagine, I think, for an economist or someone who's not a biologist, how different the way we think about safety is, because safety almost always means, you know, at worst, the safety of one or two or three lab techs. We have never really before contemplated safety that affects people who are third parties. And I think it's a fundamental shift. Yeah. It's not only for gain of function research, it's also for other types of pathogen research. And it's really fundamental and different for people in biosafety.
That's actually interesting. I would have thought they would have considered these implications for the broader population.
Too new. It's too new.
Well, Alina, what are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I think that this pandemic has revealed a lot of gaps of knowledge and weaknesses in these programs. Mm. So, for example, I really don't want to point out specific people or programs, but a lot of this money that's gone off to fund work in other countries are not transparent. Like, what have we gotten back for that money? We haven't even been able to access a database. don't even have access to a spreadsheet on how many animals have been sampled, which year, and what was found. That's kind of nuts that a lot of millions of dollars are going to these programs with no accountability. So I think that needs to change. I don't think any of it was malicious or anything, but I honestly perceive it almost as it's a feel-good grant. Like, it looks like it's going to, you know, fund research in developing countries, or it sounds good on paper, so the money disappears, but there's no, like, record keeping. So that's really bad. So I think lessons are being learned, and I hope to see that new policies implemented with these programs where money is going to fund other countries. But one thing I wanted to add to about the U.S. having a leadership position on this work, I think that's very true. But I'm also wary of some politics here in the U.S. where people are claiming that if this virus, COVID-19 virus, came from a lab, that means the U.S. funded the creation of this virus. The U.S. definitely has a leadership role, but it's not responsible for mistakes or, you know, possibly misguided programs that happen in every single country on Earth. So, there needs to be some balance in this assessment.
And I think your point about accountability is really important, again, going back to Mark's point about the negative externality, right? Because it has such a huge implication, we have seen that now in COVID, it basically has the implications for the entire world population, which not many events do, right? And so I think in that case, accountability and transparency are even much more important. Well, we're out of time. I would like to thank both of you. It's been a really interesting discussion, and your viewpoints are very appreciated. And thank you for your time. I know both of you are very busy. So thanks for being here.
Thank you.